Before we get started, I just want to remind everyone that this information discussed today is not intended to be or construed as investment advice. Please consult a professional advisor before putting a loony in any of these financial markets.
The dirty secret is that no one's ever going to get paid back.
People have the shortest memories when it comes to investment.
We just got to get Keith into Bitcoin.
Hey, there's a bubble.
Welcome back to Looney Hour, episode 83. As always, joined by the three amigos, we've got Keith Dicker, IceCap Asset Management, and Rich Diaz of Acorn Macro Consulting. Welcome back to the show, gentlemen. What's Keith, what's shaking?
Hey, this is one of the biggest days of the year. It's the NFL scheduled release day. So this is Thursday, by the way. So it comes out on the Thursday. And for anyone who's a football geek like I am, the reason it's one of the biggest days of the year football guys, it's because you sit down and you start putting together all of these trips that you're never going to do for the year, but in your mind you're going to fly to Jacksonville for a game and then hop up to Philadelphia and then jump over to the West Coast or everything, and so you end up becoming a very good travel agent by doing this. So it's a fun day.
Warm up the old private jet there, Keith?
Yeah. We have a game lined up already. Mrs. IceCap is also into it.
Which one are you going to go to?
Well, we'll be talking about maybe the Cowboys game. So it's week 3, Sunday night. So we'll
in Dallas.
No. Over in the Bay Area.
So you don't want to get booed in the away arena.
Oh no, I'd love to go to Dallas, and because I like to eat. They have good barbecue down that way. How about you, Rich? What do you think?
I'm doing well. I have to give two shout outs. One is my sister who's been visiting me, and she got really pissed off that I didn't mention that she was here with me the last couple of weeks. So hi, Sandy. And the other thing is a shout out to my dear friend, Katie, who I was surprised to learn is a regular listener of the Looney Hour. We share a godchild and she's also visiting London, and it's been a pleasure to get to know her the last couple of years. And so hi, Katie, there you go. That's it for me. Otherwise, pretty boring week. Loads to talk about, of course, macro-wise. But yeah, so hi, Katie. Hi, Sandy. There you
surprised
go.
She hasn't turned off the show after that blowing heads comment. Anyways, so we'll get into it this week. Quite a bit to chat on. We got some update in Toronto. We've got some news. Some inflation news. We're going to get into central bank digital currencies a little bit. We had the Bank of Canada, I think, put out a survey. So we'll get into that. But as always, we'll touch it off on the housing front here. Some relatively big news. Actually, last night, apparently, the Toronto City Council voted to approve the motion to basically eliminate single family zoning. This is a pretty big deal. I mean, we've chatted about it on the show quite a bit. All the demand side measures that we've done over the last 7-8 years and very, very little focus on the supply side. And the reality is a huge chunk of the land in Toronto. Same thing here in Vancouver. I think it's well over 50% of the land is zoned single family. And so they've basically voted to remove single family zoning. And so all single family homes now will have to allow duplex, triplex, fourplexes. So, yeah, huge move there.
I have a question. Do you know what the zoning as a share of total is for, or single family zoning as a share of total is for New York or San Francisco or Dallas or whatever? Just out of curiosity, or Calgary or?
That's a good question. I honestly don't. I always find it interesting though. Like if you look at like the GTA, they'll do like those like aerial shots.
Yeah.
And you'll see like the downtown core has just got like this like concrete jungle, all these high rises. And then like all around it is just like suburban single family houses. So it kind of looks a bit odd.
You mean that's not how nature intended?
Yeah. It's like, so anyways, yeah, I think it's a big move. Now this is just, City of Toronto passing this motion. Apparently, it's the largest city in North America to propose such changes. So it's interesting because they could sort of set the stage for, I think, a lot of other cities that are dealing or grappling with, housing crunch. And so I know like people have asked about Vancouver. It's already been It was already tabled in the city of Vancouver. They were trying to increase the density on single family lots. The BC government, David Eby, about a month ago said that they're projecting for the fall to remove all single family zoning in the province of BC. So they want to get rid of single family zoning in the entire province. So that I think we're seeing this precedent being set. Now, keep in mind, this was actually set in New Zealand. I think it was in Auckland, New Zealand. They actually did this 3-4 years ago. And if you look at like housing under construction, it's off the charts. It's like way higher than like any other city. You can kind of see like when that policy was announced, you just see all the housing that started going under construction. And so I think this is going to help. I think it's going to help things. It's not an overnight solution. It's probably a 10 plus year situation, but I think it's a step in the right direction.
So it seems to me then that this should increase demand for single family properties.
100%.
Price should go up, right? Yeah. As soon as something comes on the market, now you can have a developer move in pretty quickly to make a bid.
Yeah, two things basically. At the end of the day, you still have to run the math, which is like the math suggests that the numbers are still pretty tight. So if you took a single family house, you tear it down, and you build, you know, a triplex or a fourplex, and you go to resell them, well, what sale price can you get? Or if you're going to rent them, like what rentals can you generate? So like if you actually pencil the numbers, the numbers are still pretty tight. So it's not like a home run lottery where, hey, you go and buy a single family house and convert it to a fourplex and you'll make $1 million. It's really not that simple. So I think there's going to be upwards pressure on land prices as a result. But like I said, landowners are the winners, I think, in the near term. And then over the long term, you know, over 10 plus year play, I think that the rest of society, young families, for example, will benefit, because I think you'll have an oversupply of these duplexes, triplexes that will mitigate price growth.
Just imagine if someone called the bottom in the Canadian housing market a few months ago. You look like a rock star now. That's great, Steve. That's really good news. I'm assuming it's good news to put more inventory on the market for people.
Yeah. I think we're slowly getting there. You know, speaking
I have a question,
of inventory,
though. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. Yeah, fire away.
Sorry. Quick question. Is there like a commensurate infrastructure? Transportation infrastructure. Sorry, public transportation infrastructure program that's going along with this, because it's one thing to make a city more dense, people per square foot, etc. It's another thing to have them all be driving around in cars. I live in London for now, and one of the things that makes this city absolutely livable is the tube is extensive. So the tube is the subway in this city, and there's like light rail. The buses network is amazing. You genuinely do not need a car and to live in the city. The tube is amazing. So, but you know, and I was just curious if they had, maybe it's too early, maybe they'll do it next week or whatever, but I was just curious if that was like something they had mentioned.
They did not. I mean, there's some questions around, like, obviously, if you take a single family house and you put 4 units on it, which could be, you know, instead of, let's say, 4 people in a house, you might end up with 12 on that lot.
Yeah.
Obviously, you start to question about parking situations. And so you will have a lot of people that will have to be street parking and that sort of thing. So it is going to potentially create some issues around parking. And I think there's certainly some concern around that. But I think longer term, if like, you know, Canada is obviously this, you know, green thumb, they, you know, slam it down your throats about how climate friendly we are. So obviously I think they're certainly trying to encourage people to not be driving as much. You have more density in these sort of inner city communities that are more transit friendly of that nature, that it's going to disincentivize people from driving. I know there's,
but that's
always
why, I mean, the carbon taxes are totally BS, but one thing that does make sense is public transportation and spending on it. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that you can really improve people's quality of living and put more money in their pocket if they're not spending money on a depreciating asset to go from work, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway,
okay,
something to keep an eye on.
Car prices aren't cheap these days. We'll get into that too in the latest CPI reading. But just kind of last note on the housing front before we switch gears. Just, it's interesting. I've just, you know, I was putting together like doing some research the other day, you look at Greater Vancouver's inventory where I am, and like this is where I said, like, oh, you know, the housing market might be bottoming. It was really just because I was just looking at the time of kind of like inventory, and inventory was just so low. And so standing inventory at the end of April, it was at its lowest levels since I have data going back to 2005. So if you look at how many homes are available for sale on the MLS right now, today, it's the lowest since 2005. And if I had data going back further, maybe it would be even worse. So that's, I find that really interesting, because when you start actually like peeling back the onion, you can actually see this is actually happening, not just in Vancouver, but in the GTA, in Calgary, most parts of Canada. It's happening across the United States. It's happening in Australia. So, you know, like Australia is dealing with these crazy interest-only loans. Mortgage rates are going up. Central banks still raising rates. The housing market should be crashing, but they are also running into this brick wall of no inventory. So I find it really fascinating, because I think there's got to be a bigger psychological thing that is happening here regarding people not putting houses onto the market. And I can't figure it out. Keith, you have any ideas? Why aren't you selling?
Well, it's funny. You talk about that with people selling. If you're selling, you have to have a plan to go somewhere else. And most times, if you're just selling and you're not downsizing or upsizing, the move doesn't make sense. So, I'm not selling yet. In a few years, we have a plan. Like everybody.
Yeah, there is a theory that all these boomers are aging into place and they're not moving. So maybe you're one of them.
Maybe.
That could be a good idea for a business, to take old age care, but you do a mobile.
We have that here. That's the mayor of Vancouver legitimately created a company that does that.
Well, I mean, just as far as why people aren't selling, and I do know in the US, I read an article a couple months ago. I mean, take this for what it is, but that people basically, because the mortgage rates are so high, in the US, I think the 30-year mortgage, fixed mortgage rates in the six and a quarter. So people have lots of equity, and let's say they want to upsize or move or whatever, is they can't afford the next thing, even if they have a lot of equity built in their own home. And so they're, I mean, prisoners is a bit strong a term, but you know what I'm saying? They're stuck in their existing home. And so that's why the mortgage application activity index is moribund. And, you know, people are just, they're like, okay, well, we're going to, and that's also one of the arguments is why consumer spending on services is doing so well. Cause people are like, well, we can't upgrade. So we might as well be either spending on travel, spending on groceries and stuff. And if you look at companies like D.H. Horton, Lennoxor, which is a U.S. building materials company. If you look at all those home builder bellwether stocks, they're all trending up and higher. So for all this talk of recession, et cetera, I don't know, maybe that's one reason that people are just basically reallocating their disposable income to something other than their house. Who knows? But
it's an important distinction, because like, okay, so if you're in the U.S., if I'm an American and I've got a 30-year fixed rate mortgage at 3%, like,
right,
I'm probably never leaving, because as soon as you leave, that mortgage breaks and you're subject to 6% or whatever it is today. Whereas like in Canada, you know, if you locked into the lows, you did a 5-year fixed mortgage at 1.5%, you can hypothetically port that mortgage to a new home. But the only problem is if you want a larger home, AKA a larger mortgage, the new portion that you take on, it taps on top. So they basically do like a blended average. So like they're like, okay, you ported 500,000 at 1.5% and you want an extra 250K. Well, that 250K is going to be at 5%. And so you can sort of get this like new average. So yeah, I'm surprised there hasn't been more inventory to be honest, but like I said, it seems to be a global phenomenon at this point. And so residential real estate continues to sort of buck the trend from what we're seeing is really, I think, quite a bit of disruption in the commercial real estate space.
But like one move that you young fellas may not appreciate, but for people, in my vintage, we either become empty nesters, you're on the verge of becoming an empty nester. So guys, that means when you have kids, they grow up to be old enough to move away, you know, become like a mini Rich or a mini Steve. But, we know a lot of people now at that stage. So all of a sudden, then you have too much house. I mean, the house is just too much space. So what the trade there is to, I would say you're downsizing space, but you're making sort of a lateral trade. So just say you sell your home for, you know, for X millions, you know, if you're up in this level, you know, you're going to buy a nice condo in a building where everything literally is turnkey. Cause that's, you know, that's the kind of, you know, amenities that, you know, we would want to look at, but it doesn't create any more inventory, but that's just, again, like that's the kind right. of, cause, you know, cause the kind of purchase that you're talking about now, you know, a lot of people are listening to is you're trying to buy the first house or you're trying to buy a bigger house. But I just want to share that, you know, there is another side to this.
Hey, speaking
and
that's of that,
awesome. I had an awesome view on things. What else do we have here besides?
Well, speaking of, so my last little chime in there, speaking of those first time buyers, remember that program from the federal government that they said they would basically share the down payment with the first time home buyer? So basically, Daddy Trudeau would cut you a check for up to 10%, I believe it was, of the purchase price. So it's up to 10% of your down payment. And then they would basically, essentially, it would be an interest-free loan until you sold your property. And then they would basically take like their equity. So if your house went up, they'd basically be entitled to 10% effectively because they put down 10% of the purchase. That program, we got some data from CMHC. So I think it's been implemented for the last 4 years. There's only been 400 total first-time home buyers.
400,000?
No, 400 people.
I'm sorry.
Basically, 400 people in Vancouver.
In Vancouver, or all of Canada? No,
Vancouver, Toronto, Victoria, which are essentially the three markets that actually like kind of need.
I have a relevant question. How many people were employed to run this program?
Oh man, you don't want to know. It's a lot of people working.
401 people.
Anyway, so I just thought I'd throw that in there. So
job creating machine. There we go. Right. Yeah. Another one.
Anyways. Okay. So shifting
gears.
Well,
can we talk about other government programs?
Yes, Rich has a good one to talk about. Let's dive right into that one.
Yes. Okay. So, as some of us know, the Bank of Canada has the Bank of Canada is doing consultation in the form of a public survey for the implementation of digital currencies. Now, I've been told that I'm not allowed to do this, or I'm doing it anyway. I have 7 bullet points to explain what
you said. It was 6.
Sorry. Well, I lied. Keith, too bad. Steve, mute him. So, what's a digital currency? Quickly, I promise this will be quick, but a central bank digital currency is a digital form of currency, naturally, that's issued, backed, and regulated by the central bank of a given country. So CBDC, for short, operates on a blockchain or a distributed ledger, uses encryption and stuff, and to secure and verify transactions. Some people already know this. Forgive me. This is for the people who don't know. So 3, it can be stored on a digital wallet, accessed through mobile phones or computers, and 4, remember this one for later, it can be programmed with features such as smart contracts, which can automate transactions, etc. It can be designed to include privacy features such as an anonymous transaction. Remember that for later too. And it can allow, and now this is at number 5, sorry, 6, is it can allow governments to track and monitor financial transactions. And it can, and of course, aid in detecting and preventing illicit activities. All right, so that was it. I think that was 6 or 5, I lost count. But anyway, that's what a central bank digital currencies. I think Canadians should be absolutely terrified of that. Now Keith says it's inevitable, he's probably right. But the reason I think it's people say, Rich, why do you care so much about this? I think just the last 2 points, I promise it'll be quick, but the last 2 points is because of the smart contract. So besides the fact that I don't think it's a good that a government monitors and tracks every single person's financial transactions, I just inherently have a skepticism towards where that information will be used, how that information will be used. The key thing, which I think terrifies me, is the smart contracts. Smart contracts have a potential to allow governments or central banks to introduce discriminatory practices. Smart contracts can be executed, there'll be pre-programmed rules or conditions, And for example, a government or central bank could program a smart contract to allocate a certain CBDC, so current currency, or interest rate, or prevent a certain transaction by a group of individuals or a group based on their demographic characteristics, such as age, gender, race, nationality, or a certain medical decision that they may or may not have taken over a certain time, or based on a specific product, such as gasoline. So it's what the natural proclivity of governments and central banks that never want less power. They always want more power. My friends at home might kill me for this, but I believe it's to be true, is that to me, it's just so easy for governments to basically implement their own political policy via a central bank digital currency, e.g., we want consumers to consume less gasoline. Therefore, we limit the amount of gasoline that a specific person is able to purchase with their digital currency. Now, some people would call me, I hate conspiracy theories. Anyone who knows me knows that it's true. But if you go and look up the Bank of International Settlements, the general manager, the guy, the big...
You can't miss him.
You can't miss him. I'm sure he's a smart chap, but he has made that view explicit. So has Christine Lagarde. I was going to say something that was going to get us in trouble. Anyways, she is the central bank governor of the ECB, European Central Bank, and other very prominent technocrats and legislators have made this clear. So, yeah. Anyway, so that's central bank digital currency. That's one of the reasons why I hate it. I did that as quick as I could. I only had 6 bullet points. Boys, over to you.
Keith, there's a consultation, I'm told.
Yeah. Well, first thing, what I find really interesting, by the way, you didn't say you hate it. You don't hate anything, remember?
I dislike it. You're right. Sorry. No H word.
Yeah. We said you were afraid of it. Like, you know, Steve is afraid of lead paint, as an example. People didn't know that. I'm afraid of a blitzing safety because that could really screw up what play you're trying to run. But, you know, for Rich to say he's afraid of this and then you're going down the reasons why, I 100% agree with him. So if you go to the Bank of Canada's website or any of the other guys that are, you know, promoting this aggressively and they don't mention any of these other factors that are at play. So now this week, a couple of days ago, the Bank of Canada, they tweeted out, you know, they wanted people to watch this video and take part in a survey. And the comments were, of course, outstanding. Is that what they call ratioed? I just learned that.
Yes, yeah, it is.
That's...
But what does it mean? Like it's mostly negative or unsupporting?
Just here for the, yeah, basically like the comments basically dwarf like the original tweet. Like they'll get like more. Okay.
Instead of likes and retweets, you comment, and normally the comments are sarcastic or mean or bad or whatever.
Oh, so I'm ratioed quite a bit then, I think.
By your kids, probably.
I mean, so. But let's, you know, so Rich went down really is the social credit score avenue. I got that's where you went. And it's kind of like that British TV show, Black Mirror. You know, that's a recurring theme.
That was a great show.
Yeah. It's really good, especially the one with the robot dogs. Did you see that one?
Yeah.
That might be coming. But back to this theme, though, with the central bank digital currency. So you know, Rich is correct. They are going to be able to limit or restrict or to provide any one person or entity with more or less credit. You know, I say on a whim, they say, no, it's not going to work like that. However, once this mousetrap is set up, it's there. And just to remind everyone what didn't kind of happen in Ottawa last year, it absolutely did happen. But, you know, they would be very easy for any government to turn that switch on or off if you want to restrict someone's access to money or credit, whatever you want. Steve, are you looking?
Well, I was going to say, you take that, first, you layer on layer on Bill C-11.
Oh boy.
I don't want to get too much into the weeds, but I don't know.
We don't need to. Let's stick to what we've been told by the people who are designing this and trying to implement it. And they've said it explicitly many, many times that you could use this technology to promote social welfare or incentivize certain behaviors or enforce laws or regulations. And that is baked into the technology. And so, first of all, why do you need to do this if, you know, when we already have, I mean, have you ever seen your millions and millions of dollars, Keith? No, right? It lives on a ledger already. You don't, none of the money that we have, quote unquote, is physical. It's all already digital in a, so in a manner of speaking, right? It exists in.
Yeah, it's more electric. It's more electronic, right, though.
Excuse me.
I think the thing. But like, I don't know, I'm just trying to think out loud here. Like, this is obviously like a show for geeks, right? But like, does the average person know what the hell a central bank digital currency is or have any interest in what it is? They're probably just like, oh, this is this is what it is now. And so I don't know, it's a little bit concerned.
It is what it is. Okay, but we need to be very clear. Maybe we haven't been that clear yet. Bank of Canada and anyone else involved with it, they'll try to sell this as saying, hey, you're already electronic. You won't even notice the difference. And what other people are sharing with you that, no, it's not the same. It is not simply going from like 98% to 100%. This is a completely different, you know, financial system setup. That's where we're headed. And another thing to tie in with what Rich was just explaining, you know, it comes down to, you know, they say, well, you know, we can fight crime with it or stop illicit activities. And then it comes down to, well, who defines that? Who defines, again, what is right or wrong? And, you know, again, like, that's where the opportunity set is. But I now want to introduce something that we've actually talked about before as well. So the question comes down to why do we need this today? So it's one thing to say, well, we're almost already there, which is not true. Right? That's not true. 98% of Canadian financial transactions are already electronic, which is true, but electronic is not digital. Again, it's completely different.
Yeah.
But the other reason, you know, that I hear about and I chat with other people about, and then you read about it as well, is that by the Bank of Canada offering a digital currency option, so instead of you putting your money on a deposit as a GIC at any of your favorite bank, no matter what color t-shirt they wear, you can put it on deposit with the Bank of Canada. And then by doing that, all of a sudden you have no credit risk whatsoever. So in Canada, because Canadian banks are the most impressive, outstanding, most intelligent banks ever created, you know, this side of the universe, we don't have to worry about that. But if you just say you're in America today, you know, we're seeing the deposit run, you know, not only on small and medium-sized banks, but right across the entire system that is happening. And they're not running into a digital currency because it doesn't exist in America. And I'd be shocked if the Americans would actually implement it. But instead, they're going into money market, commercial paper type securities. But all of a sudden here in Canada, if you had an option to say, put your money on deposit with the Bank of Canada, get the exact same rate in GIC that any of your favorite bank is going to offer you, and the whole system has already gone digital, why would you put it with a commercial bank? No, you just wouldn't do it. Because if you're in the commercial banking sector or platform, all of a sudden you involve credit risk with this. And the Bank of Canada, they have papers out where they specifically address this, because commercial banks are terrified of this. They're saying, whoa, all of a sudden, it's one thing for them to compete with each other, you know, for any rate-sensitive product. It's another thing to have to compete with the Bank of Canada, because, you know, they're not there. But anyway, the Bank of Canada, they do reference this in a lot of different papers, and they say, no, we're going to work with the commercial banks. You know, we're not competing with them. But again, this is their words. Like, we're not making it up here on the Loony Hour, because, you know, we don't make things up. But this is the avenue where it's going. What do you think, Steve?
Well, I just, to question that point, because it's like, I know there's been some questions around commercial banks ultimately end up creating money, right? When a commercial bank creates a loan, they are creating new money into the system or into the economy. So the question really is basically central banks, there's no need for commercial banks because you got these CBDCs. Essentially, I'm assuming central bank becomes the sole creator of money, basically.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about credit creation, you know, to be
right.
To be
and I'm kind of curious, like, if you're going to get like a mortgage, do you just walk up to the, you know, to Tiff Macklem and say, "Hey, buddy, I need $1 million"? And I guess they just, you know,
no. I think you would go to the Arrive Can app first, and then you can click. I'm really funny today. I'm on a roll.
Zing.
Yeah. It was not as good as your 18 points about what a central bank digital currency is.
It's only
was.
Six. I whittled it down. There's more.
They were really good. They are really good. However, but the thing is, you know, with the Bank of Canada ask for, you know, consulting the public for their views on this and questions. And people think, yeah, I mean, we can ratio this and it's, you know, it ain't going to happen. I got news for you. It is happening. It does not matter, like, two beans, what we think and what we do. It's coming down. It's going to be rammed down, you know, right down the middle. So you need
this to show is proudly sponsored by Bitcoin.
I mean, one of the things that I think is really weird and kind of annoys me, I guess, is that, you know, one of the things is to part of the reasons, again, when you again, don't take my word for it. Go on the Central Bank of Canada's website, go on the Bank of International Settlements website, read their own literature, and then you can comment, you know, and you can make all the comments you want. But one of the things is to be able to track and monitor financial transactions, which can aid in detecting and preventing illicit activities. It's like we, for example, in British Columbia, we know people have been using cash to conduct illicit activities for years. And the Bank of Canada did not seem particularly concerned about those illicit activities. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, Steve, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, the government of Canada, I'm not sure who was responsible for this, but they closed down the financial crimes unit in British Columbia. So... it's like it's a farce. It's a canard. This transactions and illicit activity thing.
Did you guys see the TD Bank stuff? Where it's like, so TD Bank, again, they're claiming that the deal with was it First New Horizon, one of the
First Horizon,
that part of the reason was because the regulators were concerned around TD's money laundering. Barricades, basically, or their scrutinizing of money laundering. I found that pretty interesting.
There are plenty of ways to do AML, which is anti-money laundering rules, or KYC, know your client. All that stuff already exists. And in certain countries, they have teeth. And in other countries, Canada, there's no interest whatsoever in trying to track down financial or white collar criminals who do this. So
it gets better. So TD Bank, the US regulators scrutinizing TD Bank's money laundering policies. And then, you know, OSFI, the Canadian banking regulator, you know, on their financial stability risks, they sort of like rank them of like what they're looking at. They've got climate in there, but they don't have anything around money laundering. That's a true story, by the way.
As
a regulated firm and individual, I can assure you there is an interest in money laundering and anti-money laundering activities. So I mean, those processes are out there. There's like, we file reports all the time. You're required to do it. I think that what we're really referencing, though, is, you know, the real estate, the housing market, which is an unregulated industry. So it's kind of funny because the regulated industries, there's absolutely holes in the net. You know, something can shoot through, that can happen. But I think, though, the real conversation is what we're referring to is in the housing market, where money just came in. Yeah, but if the way you fix that is with a central bank digital currency. As soon as the money comes into the country, you have it now.
You mean those pre-sale condo returns aren't those guarantees on pre-sale condos aren't regulated? Have you seen some of those ads? They're amazing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, so that was my piece on central bank digital currencies. I'm really not a big fan of them. Keith, in your infinite wisdom, he's probably right about the inevitability of such things. Hopefully we can do our part to push back. I will.
While we're on the conversation of banks, though, I was hoping to quickly chat about, we've seen some of this mess in these U.S. regional banks. And then there's a good chart that was circulating online showing the difference between deposit trends in Canada and the U.S. And so I think it's worth pointing that out, because I'm sure there's obviously some Canadians that are looking and seeing what's happening in these U.S. regional banks, you know, some of them blowing up. Should I pull my money? Should I move it? Should I sprinkle 100K across multiple different banks? And so we're actually not seeing any real deposit outflow issues in Canada versus the U.S., but I think there's some important distinctions, Rich.
Well, I think this Canadians have no choice. Sorry, I'm laughing, because in the U.S., I think there's, what, 4,800 banks, big, small. There's 25 systemically important banks, so the JP Morgans of the world. And then you've got a much, much, much larger, like, thin tail. I don't know which way it goes. It's positively or negatively skewed. Forgive my CFA knowledge. But, you know, it's like we only have six banks or seven or whatever. I mean, it's a joke. I mean, I don't think that. And also, frankly, I don't think that Canadian depositors are as sophisticated with respect. And I think the third reason is probably the money market funding.
Yeah. Can you sort of like differentiate that? Because, like, I mean, basically everyone in Canada, right? If you're like, oh, I'm earning, you know, 0% on my checkings account, like, you basically just roll it into a GIC. And my understanding,
this is a question for Keith.
Yeah, Keith. So my understanding is a GIC is still considered like a deposit at the bank. Correct?
Well, a GIC is a liability. So it's your asset. So it's the bank's liability.
Someone was trying to tell me otherwise on the social webs there.
That my GIC, like, is a bank's asset?
Well, no. So basically, like, what I'm saying is, like, if let's say you got 100, let's say you got 50 grand in your checking account or savings account, and it's earning 0%. So you're like, listen, I'm going to roll this into RBC's 1-year GIC at 4.5% and earn some interest. So, like, my understanding is that's not like a deposit outflow out of RBC.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, it's correct. Still, yeah. It stays on their balance sheet. So that 50K, so the bank gets that. And let's just say they buy commercial paper with it. So say they're yielding 4% on it. And, you know, Steve, you're a realtor. So you just put it in the bank because you're running in tens of thousands of dollars a day, just churning through your account. And you don't buy anything with it. You just leave it in the bank account. So that's really good for the bank's, you know, net interest margin, because they're making 4% and they're paying you nothing. All of a sudden, you roll that into a GIC, and just say that GIC, let's just say collectively the bank will say, you know, we're going to give you 3.8%. I know the numbers are a bit off with today's rates, but consider that. So all of a sudden, you're getting paid 3.8, and, you know, the bank is still earning 4, for example, if you want to make it really simple. So now they're only making 20 basis points, you know, on that trade. But on their balance sheet, all of a sudden, you know, the commercial paper that the bank bought, that's their asset. But then they have a matching liability on the other side, because it's your money. You know, they have to pay that out to you. Hmm. Is that what you want?
I have a question.
Yeah, no, it's interesting.
Sorry, Keith, you have a question. Dude, does Canada have a money market account in this, a money market in the same way that that the US does?
It's not that big or liquid.
Like, I haven't heard of any Canadians going, like, I'm investing in money market funds.
There are money market funds available in Canada. Absolutely. But you look at your universe. What, you know, what can the manager buy? So you're looking at T-bills, for example. It's not really a money market, but it's, you know, less than 3 days and like that. You know, and the banks are issuing short-term paper. So you buy that. There's also you're going to get short-term issuance by other big Canadian companies. Like, I imagine Brookfield and those guys are issuing paper. You might have some U.S. firms that are set up shop in Canada. They need to borrow in Canadian dollars, so they do like that. But it's not nearly as big and robust as the U.S. money market. It's enormous in the U.S.
Is the U.S. now, like, this might be a dumb question, but if I'm just a average Joe in the U.S. and I'm like, well, I need to earn a return. So I can buy, let's say, a short dated treasury and earn whatever it is today. I don't know, 5%. Is that interest deductible if you buy a U.S. treasury as an American citizen?
From a tax perspective?
Yeah.
That's I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. I thought I'd read that somewhere. Well,
I don't know either.
I'm sure one of our listeners here can.
Yeah, definitely.
We do not provide tax advice.
Yeah, that's right.
No, I just thought because like if it was
to
like,
be that fair, would be... we do offer a lot of investment advice. You know, sometimes it's right, sometimes it's wrong, but we do that.
I just figured like if I, you know, that would be an extra incentive, which I just think just highlights why you're seeing all these outflows out of these U.S. regional banks and whatnot, just to into U.S.
No,
treasuries,
I don't think
into money market
funds. It's like, not a tax. It's not a tax run at all. People are
well, no, I was just saying it's an extra incentive.
Yeah, it might show up later, maybe, if there is an advantage to it. But
it seems like the U.S. Money, thing to do. You'd be like, hey, it's patriotic to buy like a U.S. T-bill. We'll give you.
It's not 1941. It's not 1941.
Yeah. At the end of the day, you know, if you believe in, you know, what is the term, Rich? Like rent-seeking entities or profit-seeking? You always do to maximize your own household net worth, right? Yeah. If you're not doing it, it's just because you're just not aware of it. Like very few people are going to make a financial decision for the benefit of the whole country and not benefit themselves. That's what a donation will do. So that's what, you know, very wealthy entities, households will do. But overall, if every, you know, household and corporate entity, not government, but if those two components, I guess, are always like seeking to maximize their profits, that will allocate capital efficiently. And that's what will, you know, create growth. So right now what's happening, so the efficiency with this, the efficiency part is people are afraid of not getting their money back, because if the bank goes under, it's like, oh no, I won't get my money back, or it could be tied up for months, quarters, and years. So why would you keep it on deposit at a small bank in the US when you could move it to a larger bank or move it to a money fund and get the exact same return on it with no risk or less risk? You know, it's a pretty easy decision to make. And that's the challenge the Americans have right now. You know, that's what's happening.
I have another wrinkle, which is probably a little, I think I just answered my own question, which makes me feel a little dumb from 2 minutes ago, which is, I think part of the reason why Canada has no or limited money market account is because, unlike the US, which has a huge and robust corporate bond market. So I think, if someone will correct me if I'm wrong, but half of all non-financial corporate debt is bonds. And so let's just say for argument's sake, it's 50-50 in the US, where in Europe, it's like 90% of non-financial corporate debt is loans. And I would hazard a guess that Canada is the same situation, where there's very relative to total non-financial corporate debt. I'm trying to quickly dig up the chart while I talk. I think I have it already, so I'll share it in the Substack. But yeah, so it's just the ratio of where that debt comes from. And so because it's, so when you borrow from the bank, you don't create that little kind of unique little liability, e.g. a bond maturing in 3 years or 2 years or 5 years or 10 years for, let's say, Apple or Microsoft or Bell Canada or what have you. And so most of the lending is bank centered rather than a 50-50 split or a 60-40 split or what have you. And I'll be happy to share that chart just to make sure I haven't screwed that up. But I think that helps explain why the money market is so big in the US.
Yeah, I think it's you know, a good time here to jump over to US CPI.
I want one more bank comment. We're gonna be like, I have 17 more bank comments to make.
No, come on.
Comment number one. No, it's just an observation. The Canadian bank stocks are continuing to leak lower. And some of them are now back below the 2019 levels. So just before the pandemic hit. Two of the bigger ones, I call them the blue shirts, right? So those guys were still a bit higher. And again, it just suggests to us that, you know, that this direction we're going here. Nothing has been broken yet, but we're definitely getting a bit of a bend here in this.
You've been all over that to your credit. You've been all over the Canadian.
Yeah, and guess remember, like we always like to say that the investment world is a probability driven world. So nothing is 0-100%. You know, of course, you know, things are, you know, 0-1%. But in terms of like of a risk event happening, just because the probability is increasing doesn't mean it has to happen. But, you know, we're clearly going down this path now with the Canadian economy that if we do hit a hard landing of any kind, it's going to knock some wheels off here. Unlike over in Britain, for example. So in what do the Brits do today? I saw a great quote. So the Bank of England came out today, by the way, and there were no surprises. But one thing they managed to do was, you know, they successfully managed to forever tame the business cycle. So what that means is they are no longer ever predicting a recession to ever occur in history of Britain, basically. So
wait, you have to explain that. Sorry, I don't understand.
So they've revised their growth estimates upwards, right? And for the economy, they're expecting the economy to grow faster. Jeez. And stronger than they were before.
Someone's got to get Andrew here. Bailey off the sauce.
Well, you know,
but that's the point with Canada as well, right? Like even, you know, the Bank of Canada, they're suggesting, yeah, you know, maybe we will have a nice slowdown or something, but not a bad slowdown, just a nice slowdown.
You know what would prevent future recessions? A central bank digital currency.
No.
He's right. I think it
Someone's going to clip you on that. Tiff Macklem is going to clip Tiff. We've done a consultation, and Looney Hour host Steve has.
We only got 3 feedback.
That's right.
Canadian. Speaking of the, you know, you were talking about recession there, Keith. Potential hard landing. So Canadian consumer insolvencies rose back to pre-COVID levels in March. So we're starting to see potentially what looks like higher interest rates. That 400 basis points in 12 months might finally just beginning to catch up with some of these households. So that'll be something watching.
But what's interesting now, because I think there's been a lot of conversations on in the Twitter world as well, and no one knows the answer yet until it either happens or it doesn't happen. But now, obviously, and plus, you know, Tiff Macklem spoke last week. I think it was the day after we did our podcast last week. And, you know, during his speech, you know, he suggested that, yeah, if inflation has taken off again, we will absolutely raise rates again. Whereas I think, you know, some folks here on the podcast were saying, yeah, they're not going to raise again, like they're over with. But, you know, the Aussies did it, of course, and the Americans have yet to stop hiking. I think they will hike again now in June coming up.
You do? You think they're going to hike in June?
Yeah, absolutely. Unless something snaps in two, right? So we'll again, that's the thing with markets, right?
That's a future Twinkie bet, I think.
But again, right, you know, every day there's new data coming out. I mean, like we had 2 inflation data sets yesterday and today for the US. You know, things can if something breaks, then yeah, you know, they won't be raising rates. But as of right now, if we continue on the same track, path, journey, not Aerosmith, you know, we're you know, they will hike again. But it seems like, though, that conversation is coming back. But again, it's not our view that the Bank of Canada will raise rates again. But if they do, you know, then we have this, you know, this debt story that you just introduced again, Steve. So it's a tough call for these guys. I wouldn't want to have to do it.
Just to complete the circle here, in the UK, there's still a bunch more rate hikes being priced in. So if you look at you know, the mark, I can't remember what instrument they use. I think they use bank rates or whatever it is, but similar to the OIS or similar to the Fed funds rate in the US, except I can't recall what it is for the UK. Sorry, I screwed that up. But anyways, if you look at the probability distribution, they have hikes priced into 5.25. They have, you know, 50% chance you'll get to 5.25 in the UK by November. So there's still some banks that are on the warpath, so to speak.
Interesting. Getting to that, Keith, you know, you're saying, okay, potentially another rate hike from the Fed, which is maybe a little bit out of consensus at this point, but I would imagine a lot of this comes down to inflation and the jobs numbers in the coming weeks here. But so we did have US CPI, a couple of days ago, Rich? And
yeah.
That was that right on the screws, roughly 4.49?
Yeah, I think it was exactly as expected.
What was your takeaway on that? Like, parsing through it.
Yeah, everybody knows I kind of go through this. I think a couple of interesting points, less than six points. So it fell, but it's stopped falling. So there's the rate of change that's year on year. There's the rate of change month on month. So month on month was still positive. So price, but the rate of change year on year continues to go down. I know this is getting kind of cumbersome, but that's important. I think what's the couple of takeaways for me was the core inflation is basically more or less flat over the last 3 or 4 months at 5.5%. Some stuff that we talked about a lot last year is conveniently being left off the Twitterverse this year, which is the used cars and trucks is now up 4.5% month on month, or 4.4% month on month, whatever it is. Your favorite indicator, Steve, shelter is starting to roll over, which is really interesting. It's still a huge, still the largest contribution to core inflation, but it has started to slow. And there's, if you look at the OER, then what is it called?
Owner's equivalent rent.
Yeah, owner's equivalent rent. Thank you. And if you look at rents, those are all coming off pretty significantly off their highs, but still positive. So we'll see. The thing I thought was really interesting is the goods inflation. So if you strip out everything that's going down, everything else that's left over is going up. No, I'm kidding. But if you look at core goods, which is commodities, less food and less energy, that's started to rise. So it bottomed in January or February. My chart's too small to confirm that, but now we're starting to get 2 or 3 consecutive months of increase. And I just thought it was really interesting. I mean, the analogy and allegory that I like to use is, like, you know, inflation shocks, which is what shutting down the global economy is, and screwing up that, not to put too fine a point on it, but is like jumping into a swimming pool and not a lake. When you jump into a lake, there's ripples, but they go out and they don't, I'm not big enough to make a sufficient, you know, splash or ripple. But if you jump into a swimming pool, the ripples go out, they hit the edge of the swimming pool, and eventually some of them do come back. They're smaller, it might be muted, but they do. And I think it would be, again, I don't know what's going to happen this summer, but I think it would be real. I wouldn't be surprised at all if you sort of get some of that sort of wave hit that pool wall and then come back and surprise people to the upside over the summer. And we'll see.
Sometimes you might hit your head off the pool wall as well.
Oh, I still have a scar.
I can see it. Like, it's impressive.
Keith, what was your kind of takeaway? I mean, like, just to chime in, I'm like, it's funny, like, Rich, you and I were joking about this offline, but it's like, you could literally, like, you go on Twitter, you read the CPI report, and like, everybody basically just like picks apart what they want to see in the inflation report. So everybody has like this inherent bias, whether you're like an inflationista or a deflation type of guy or gal. Like, it is amazing to see, like,
dude, yeah, you're sharing people the secrets of my job.
Well, yeah, it's like, I mean, I like David Rosenberg. He's a smart guy, but he's obviously in the deflation camp. So he's out there tweeting, well, he's like, you know, if you strip out inflation in cars, you know, we've got outright deflation. You're like, well, I mean, you kind of need to live and drive a car. So that seems a little bit irresponsible to pull that out. But Keith, what was your kind of takeaway, at least from a market standpoint?
Yeah. So what's happened now? You might remember, you know, a year ago, all the analyst estimates for any kind of inflation data point was way off. Like, it was like, holy smokes. And then that would cause an enormous market reaction. Now, you know, time can heal a lot of data sets, you know, as we all know. And so now we're back into what I would call like a normal economic data analyst estimate cycle, where the estimates are now, except for Canadian job numbers, of course, but analyst estimates are now very close to what the actual number is. And there's a bit of something in there, you know, for everyone. So, they're no longer like this enormous market moving event. So, like, yesterday in the US, and we had the CPI number, and like, there was some pretty good round trips taking place on, you know, and equities and FX and the metals and everything yesterday and whatever. But we're now getting closer, you know, to that next stage or phase. So it's like, is 3 or 4% the new 2? Like, who knows, right? But the point is, what markets are more interested in is what is the monetary cycle. So, and again, it's increasingly looking like, you know, we've almost reached that plateau. So now whether the Americans do another quarter point hike or not, it might seem incredibly important in the near term, but in the longer term, it's quite clear that they're almost done, which means, you know, the rest of the world is almost done. And then, you know, the next question is, well, how long is everyone on pause for? And then the Brits will say, well, they'll never be on pause because there'll never be a recession again. So, you know what I mean? So it's just the odd moment we had is now almost over.
I think next year we should start making maybe bets on who's going to be the first to cut. Cause I've got my dark horse for the first to cut.
It feels like nature.
I think
healing.
that is the next bet to go with. What story about that, Steve? What do you have?
Well, no, I just said it feels like nature is healing. I mean, like, just going back and looking at some of these charts, I mean, remember like the days, obviously being in the housing sector, the days of talking about like lumber and that was just going to these crazy new heights. And every week it was like lumber was being repriced. I mean, that's down 75% from the peak, and it's two years ago. It literally peaked almost to the day 2 years ago. So like that, you're seeing, I think, oil prices obviously coming in right now. I remember there's like that huge story with, like, you know, the sentiment around like wheat as Russia invaded Ukraine. It was like wheat prices exploded higher. The Economist wrote a big cover article on it. And then, of course, it was like that was the top. And since then, it's like a non-story. So I feel like a lot of these like sort of pandemic era inflationary booms, I think, like in my view, is like nature is healing. I think that inflation's still coming down, but to your point, I think maybe three is the new two.
So one thing that's great with the whole lumber story, though, you know, I think they finally figured out that, you know, you're not going to get COVID out in the woods by yourself, so that you should be allowed to chop down a friggin' tree. But, you know, it was a classic supply, you know, demand story, because demand did not stop because everyone got free money and everything. But, you know, the supply story came up. I think we need to talk a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit about the U.S. debt ceiling story.
Oh, yeah. It's, yeah. That's
a getting a lot of attention and everything. So, I mean, you know, and we could always be wrong, of course, but, you know, this is one of these things that you announce and it's like all of a sudden 24 hours later, you're like, nah, you're wrong, right? The U.S. blew up. It this happens every cycle, and it's a political mainstream media event all the time. And usually they come to some kind of a resolution, like literally you see them bleary-eyed, like at 3 a.m, you know, they finally came out with the solution and stuff like that. But the U.S. is not going under anytime in the next week or a month, whatever deadline they're trying to set here. Even if there is some kind of a technical default, a default means you're not getting your money back, right? It means you're getting like pennies on the dollar back. And that ain't happening with the U.S. debt market at this point in the cycle. At some point down the road, it could happen. It would probably be the last in line, because up between that, you know, everyone else is having their struggles with it. But, you know, we're getting a lot of calls and concerns. You know, they're saying, oh, the Republicans are going to blow up America, or the Democrats they're never going to negotiate. And CNN is doing this, Fox is doing that, CBC, they want to get back on Twitter now, apparently.
Fox is banned in Canada. Well, they're talking about it.
Yeah, it's but again, with the whole U.S., you know, debt ceiling, just appreciate it for what it is. Which, of course, you could also look at from a different perspective. So what is Canada's debt ceiling, by the way? What do we have?
I don't think we have one.
Correct. What do the Brits have?
They do not have one.
Yeah, it's a trick. Like, no one else in the world has this thing. So to think that a debt ceiling is going to do, and, you know, and instill fiscal prudence at the government level, I mean, you're completely naive, ignorant, or drunk or something, right? It just doesn't happen. So let them play their game, and they'll come out saving the day once again. Yet they'll never become close to trying to close the gap, because they can't do it because of the entitlements that they have to spend on Social Security and military spending.
And good question for you.
There you have it.
I feel like, as someone that doesn't necessarily pay overly close attention to this, I feel like I read about this debt ceiling every single year. And then, like you said, it's like the final hour, like, okay, crisis averted. Is there something that you would take into like managing one's portfolio and like, okay, this is, while it may only be a 1% risk, but we sort of like, for the average person, to sort of like hedge or be prudent until this inevitably gets resolved, or you just eventually just fade it as noise?
I don't know of any professional manager who is trading this. Like, again, we just see it as, I think the monetary cycle is more important than this right now, and is the economy rolling over and stuff like that. But you know, the retail investors might be, you know, pretty hyped up about it because it's spectacular.
Zero Hedge is going wild.
It's spectacular, right? Yeah, yeah. Anyway,
Steve, the reason you might have read a lot about it over time is because since I think the debt ceiling was instituted in 1917, God love the internet, and I think it's been raised basically over 100 times. Now, that could be wrong. I'm going to just double check that, but it's basically a lot. Let's just say it's more than just a couple of times. It is an incredible amount. If you just Google, anyone could do this. If you just Google debt ceiling, you can see that not only has it increased many, 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 many times since its inception, but it does so bipartisan. Whether the House of Representatives is Democrat or Republican, whether the Senate is Democrat or Republican, whether the president is Democrat or Republican, this is, I mean, I agree with Keith, but I just thought it's just amazing. If you look, you can see, I think it's, yeah, something like 90 or whatever times. It's kind of funny.
So I'm in a pretty cool MySpace chat group. So we email once a week and we all think the same on there. What else? I think I have one. Oh, this might be of interest or may not be. The White House, that's the American head of state, they are in the process of recommending that short selling of bank stocks be temporarily banned. There she was. That's how you end the show right there.
Wait, Keith, you're old. You were around this. You were probably, what, 30, 40, 50 years old in the Reagan administration. Wasn't short selling banned until like 1982 or something?
I don't remember that summer that well, but whenever there's a crisis in the financial sector, it's always, we got to find out who caused this. It's the short seller that caused it. Let's go get him. And of course they can never find or define him, you know, who did
or
it
her. Or
whatever. And anyway, this is coming out. It's nonsensical. Like you need a properly functioning market allows shorts to happen. That's just so if they want to say, hey, you can't short anything, the entire futures market, which has way more nominal value of anything else traded in the planet, you would just have to pause that entire marketplace. Because by definition, people think, oh, you're a bad thing, you're shorting, but people don't realize that, you know, there are speculators and there are hedgers. So somebody who might be, say, shorting bank stocks, they might be doing it to protect another part of their exposures.
They might be massively long and they don't want to sell out of their position and hedge their position, right?
Of course, because the tax man might run in or something like that, right? But again, it's an incredibly complicated, efficient market we have. But when politicians start jumping around saying, oh, we're going to ban short selling, you can't allow the bank stocks to go down. I mean, God forbid, you know, the Canadian bank stocks go down. I mean, what's going to happen then? So anyway, that did catch my attention this week. So there's a lot of noise coming out of the government circles, I guess. So to
summarize,
no, guys, geez, digital bank currencies and the White House debt ceiling.
Fade the noise, get long CBDCs, and we'll all be good. So I think that's the good place to wrap it up. As always, guys, appreciate your support. All we ask is that you share this episode with at least one friend, family member. Continue to build the Looney Hour community. Leave us a 5-star review on Spotify or Apple, and we'll see you next week.